Hello, and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff, and today we're going to talk about the silent disabilities, development of the brain, and injury to the brain. These are the ones for which we get very little appreciation. You know, it's not as if there's a cast on your leg and you can have all your friends sign it. It's that there's something that's not quite working right in the brain. And it's either something that you're born with, that develops as you mature, or it's an injury. It could be a sports injury. It could be an automobile injury. You could fall down the stairs and hit your head. Or an increasing number of veterans returning from Iraq. By some estimates, more than half of the soldiers deployed to Iraq will come home with a traumatic brain injury. Our guest today is Leo Sarkissian, who is the CEO of the ARC of Massachusetts, an advocacy group that works primarily with children with autism and other developmental disabilities and intellectual disabilities to try to optimize their function, make sure that they can recover to the extent that they can, and then to live productive and independent lives. So please stay with us. We'll be right back after this message with Leo Sarkissian. The Powerful Patient works with people who are dealing with complex medical conditions or who may be struggling to get a diagnosis. We help you learn how to manage your health, form a partnership with your healthcare providers, and manage your healthcare team. The Powerful Patient is produced by the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance. It is funded by you, our listeners, through your generous contributions. Please read about us on our website at powerfulpatient.org. We welcome your questions either by email or by telephone. And please contribute to help bring this program back another day. Thank you.
Would you mind starting off by introducing yourself and talk a little bit about what the ARC is?
Sure. My name's Leo Sarkissian, and I'm the executive director of the ARC of Massachusetts. And we represent about 180,000 people and families across the state, and we're part of the ARC movement, which is a national movement started in the 50s for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Historically, you know, and probably still a little bit, we're identified with the terms mental retardation and developmental disabilities. And as times have changed, we've sort of tried to change the way we talk about who we represent. And it's a far different world today than when we started 50 years ago.
Right.
So anyway, there's 21 chapters of the ARC in Massachusetts, as well as other organizations that we work with. And we've been involved in all kinds of legislative work, public education work, and some examples, getting services for kids in school. Special education was a big part of our work in the 70s, and then in, you know, even to the current day, where we've been involved in trying to get more supports and services to adults with disabilities as they get older and, you know, have less and less resources in these times. So,
right. Now, ARC, is that an acronym?
It is not any longer. It was an acronym years ago, so we really talk about being a disability advocacy organization for people with disabilities. Yeah.
Right. Now, there was an incident not too long ago when a radio announcer was talking about autism in a somewhat disparaging way.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit more about what happened?
Sure. On the Michael Savage Show, which is, you know, broadcast nationally on the radio, the host went on a tirade and basically said that the parents were responsible by not getting the kids in line for the problem with their autism, and that they just, you know, either
they
spanked
were just
them.
Badly behaved children.
Right, badly behaved kids, and he showed a real lack of knowledge. You know, I mean, later he sort of backtracked and said, no, you know, the show's producers have said, no, he was just saying there's a very high rate of reporting autism, it's not clear, but that's not what he was saying. He was saying kids just need to be hit, and, you know, he showed really a lack of understanding about autism in general. In fact, the same guy, I don't know if it was 2 years ago, had done the same with the in relation to other disabilities, and it's not an unusual thing. This happens from time to time. And what we were worried about was two things. You know, was the impact of the stigma, basically to say the parents weren't being good parents, and that's really simply the issue. You know, mm-hmm. And we thought that was, you know, not only a bad thing to do, but it's just wrong. It's not factually correct.
Right. And then, it's enough of a burden on his parents already.
Right. And secondly, we thought, what if people actually believed them? You know?
Right.
And they might not seek the help and support they need. And so we thought about those kinds of things. And the third thing we thought about, that we actually sent a letter to the company and requested his, you know, at minimal, a suspension just a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. We made that request. We thought about the fact, boy, this really fits in his agenda, because he's always saying that, you know, there's too much public spending, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't it be great, you know, if in fact not only, you know, is this a parental problem, and that means we don't need to spend money, you know, for school-age kids, we don't need to worry about what happens when they become adults. We can just ignore the problem and it'll go away. So we thought it, you know, interesting from that perspective, too.
Right. These, as you say, the mental and psychological disabilities are so difficult because there's no obvious sign that this child is disabled. He's not mm-hmm. on crutches. He's not in a wheelchair. He doesn't have a bandage on any appendage.
Mm-hmm.
And so people with that kind of problem don't get the sympathy they deserve a lot
mm-hmm.
of times. The community that I deal with has brain tumors, and so once your hair grows out over the scar, you don't look like you have any sort of problem, but often there are residual problems from traumatic brain injury that, again, are kind of occult, that
mm-hmm.
you don't see them, obviously. And so people don't always appreciate the struggle that's going on inside of you.
Oh, yeah. You mean like it's really like a hidden disability on
it's
some level,
hidden
right?
Disability,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. And sure, and so whether it's somebody who has surgery who maybe can't be as quick as they used to be because of secondary impact maybe from the
right.
surgery on processing,
exactly.
or it's a young person with a mild, you know, form of autism or Asperger's syndrome, which is, you know, somebody can seem brilliant, you know, in certain
mm-hmm.
subjects, but socially is very difficult and gets teased and bullied. You're right. People compound. I think sometimes we feel people compound things that,
right.
for example, right, let's imagine someone with a disability who's 12 years old and kids decide not to play with him or her
mm-hmm.
because, you know, he's a little different or she's a little different, right?
Right.
And that social isolation really compounds things.
Right.
Because the very thing, you know, a child may need if they have things that result in behavioral kinds of difficulties is to be around typical, you know, kids.
Right.
So he or she, you know, one of the ways we change, you know, improve our behavior, grow and learn is through other people around us.
Right, and children want very much to be part of the pack. They
mm-hmm.
want to be accepted in the group.
Mm-hmm.
And when they're not accepted in that group for whatever the reason, that is really a difficult thing for them.
Mm-hmm.
I went through this with my brother, who had mm-hmm. a learning disability in the 1950s, when
nobody
knew from learning disabilities, you know, and it was all about he's not trying hard enough, clearly he's smart, but, you know, he just doesn't sit still long enough or apply himself. And he went through that for years until he was in college. One
mm-hmm.
of his professors identified that he had a learning disability and helped him learn how to control it.
Wow.
And in fact, he is a brilliant guy, but
mm-hmm.
he
mm-hmm.
just had this impediment that he had to learn to deal with constructively.
Right. And that was probably like a door opening or a window, you know,
absolutely.
A shade opening for him, right? That, oh,
yeah.
my goodness, there's a reason
right.
for this.
Right, the whole state change.
Right.
Yeah. So autism is getting to be rampant. Is it just that we know how to diagnose it better and it's really been there all along, or is it really on the rise?
Well, you know what? I think it's no question it's on the rise. I mean, I have some colleagues who say, well, you know, I wonder if we're just better at identifying it. But we wonder, you know, we're involved in a prevention group called Alliance for a Healthy Tomorrow
mm-hmm.
around chemical and other environmental-related impacts. And the reason we're involved in that is there's all kinds of questions, not only about, for example, vaccines
mm-hmm.
that may cause autism-like or, you know, same kinds of symptoms that you see in autism, But there's also questions about different kinds of chemicals that are used. Things simply as just recently we learned about this vinyl plastic products that are made for showers. And so your shower curtain, the inner lining, and for the first 30 days, it's been documented all kinds of chemicals are released that you use.
Right, when
lining.
You open that package and it smells bad,
right,
there's
exactly.
In fact chemicals being emitted into the environment.
Exactly. So so one question is there, is that part of the, between the vaccines and other kinds of things, is that a trigger? And, autism spectrum disorder, it's called ASD now, there's a range, from, I think we'll only know by longitudinal study in terms of what percentage of the kids with ASD have impairments around understanding and cognitive, processes that, and how different is that from, 30 years ago. But clearly, that's one factor. The second factor might be there's a broader, one psychiatrist argued that, things that used to be called childhood schizophrenia, are now being, categorized as ASD. And I don't think... That's really not what we're seeing. We're not seeing that in our sort of day to day experience as we meet families and
right.
So I don't think that's the explanation by any means. In fact, these environmental kinds of things and our in our society clearly have I would think are the biggest impact as well as things like immunizations and
right.
related matters. So. No, it's on the rise, and it's something we should care about because if we take the right steps when the kids are young, between, it's been proven, under the age of 8 years, we do some what's called early intervention with the children, help the families get the supports they need, it can be a big difference. But we really face, some problems with that. Insurance companies don't pay for the service, private insurance. So you can be a family that's, middle class, upper middle class, and your insurance company's going to reject paying for everything from speech therapy to behavioral therapy that might be needed.
Mm-hmm.
You're then involved trying to advocate with the school system to do more.
Right.
And you have some of that special education backlash we face. But, the opposite, imagine not doing anything. And a child gets older and older, and he becomes, he or she becomes, and it's more males than females, becomes too hard to handle as he becomes a teenager. Now you're into residential services and things like that.
Right, and for the parents, this is a shattering of a dream.
Mm-hmm.
Because they, obviously, when they decided to have a child, they
right.
had all sorts of goals and aspirations for that child who's going to grow up to be president or at least, some leading citizen. And then all of a sudden they've got a child who may wind up in a residential setting, and that's pretty shattering.
Right, one of the most important things for a parent, of any child with a disability, regardless of autism or other disabilities, it's really important to understand, what the disability is, learn about it. I think there's the initial mourning, anyone might go through through the process. But the ones, of course, I see a skewed picture of parents. I see the ones that are probably most addressing things, most coming to terms with
right.
it, and then seeing the gifts in the child. You got to go through that process of mourning, get over the denial, denial if some people have that,
mm-hmm.
And then saying, oh, okay, what is this about? Now let me learn about it. Okay, I didn't expect this trip. I expected a different trip, but let me understand the disability, and let me understand if it's autism, what this means. And, then you see two things usually happen in a great, in the ideal situations, folks emotionally are able to then, take the disability in the context of the whole child and
right.
see the gifts that the child has. And then from there also advocate, for the child. So I get to see more, folks that are doing that, that are helping others. The final step, this parent once said who's passed away now, who had a child with Down syndrome, she said, I knew I was sort of cured of what I was going through, in terms of my process. You can't
right.
cure the disability, but you can cure, what you get as a parent in trying to come to terms with it when I was finally thinking not just about my own child, but other people as well. And that's sort
that's
of the,
right.
Right. for all of us, by the way, whether you have a child with disability or not, are you always looking at your own world or are you able to see others? And So yeah, so it's and even, you know, obviously there's extra steps you need as a parent, which is why we believe it's so important for services to be more family friendly, mm-hmm. that think about the whole family.
Yes, as you say, it's a process that we go through as parents of such a child, to go through that grieving process, the mourning, the loss of your dreams for this child, so that you go through almost like a loss. You go through anger and denial and all the other steps of grief until you finally resolve yourself to accept the new reality of your life, to learn about how to deal with this condition and how to move forward. And hopefully both parents learn how to do that and to undertake this together. Unfortunately, it's very hard on marriages, and hopefully both parents will take hold and work this problem together. Let's take a little break here, and we'll be right back after these messages to talk some more with Leo about the kinds of challenges that families face and how to go about optimizing what your child is able to do.
This is Keith Richards, aka Just Saying. Is there cancer in your family? There is in mine. But it doesn't have to be bad. We can take action to protect ourselves. I've learned how to get screened and manage my health so that I'll live a long, healthy life. How about you? Visit www.powerfulpatient.org. Again, that's www.powerfulpatient.org. Peace.
We're back now speaking with Leo Sarkissian of the ARC of Massachusetts, an advocacy group that works with children with intellectual and developmental disabilities like autism and Down syndrome. Leo, you were mentioning that we need more family-centered services. Can you tell us more about that, please?
You know, one group that I'm impressed with that does some great stuff, and recently I went to their conference. It's called the Mass Down Syndrome Society. Mm-hmm. And they make sure their annual conference includes something for kids and includes something for the other siblings. So it's not just for the parents. And so it's a whole family experience.
Right.
So they've designed things, and I know other groups that do this, to really, parents get to know parents, learn from parents, but also the kids get to understand, oh, I'm not alone in this, you know. I might have a brother, disability, or sister, and, you know, and they're able to get past what it meant for them as a sibling, maybe some extra attention the child received or didn't receive. And, again, this applies across the board, right?
Right.
And it's a great growing experience. And, you know, what's frustrating is when you're so busy advocating for the right school services or the right adult services, you know, you're as a family, you know, you really would hope people would get it, you know, that, you know, my child does have a disability, you know, school program has to be somewhat different for him or her.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the thing we constantly deal with, and I'm sure you do too, with, you know, as people have surgery and there's certain things they face, employers to be more understanding, and the whole picture, you know.
Right, and it's a challenge for the child, it's a challenge for the family, but it's also because of the rampant growth of autism. This is a public health issue that
yes.
we all need to face up to yes. come out of our denial and really address it, and really, instead of just say, oh, those poor children, oh, those poor families,
mm-hmm.
It's also important to say, what is causing this, so that we can change whatever it is that we are doing to ourselves as a society.
Oh, great point, Joyce. I think if you don't, what does denial result in?
You get to live it again.
Right. And, you know, that we felt, and we still do, we feel the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, in terms of evaluating more aggressively immunizations. I mean, just to say, well, we know it's not a problem, you know?
Right.
They don't know, you know.
Well, I mean, and just for the benefit of all of our listeners, let's talk about vaccines for a while, because mm-hmm. there's this concern that perhaps giving children those vaccines is part of what's causing autism. Now, from what I've read, and please add or change what I'm saying here, the biggest part of the concern is the stacking of these vaccines. They'll put three in one shot and give the baby all these vaccines. And from the doctor's perspective, he's trying to make sure the baby's protected. And if he spreads them out, then the parents have to bring the child back, pay more co-pays, take more time off from work. So he's worrying that the parent's not going to do that, and therefore they stack them up and do them all at one time. But what it does is it hits the baby's immune system, and children don't have fully developed immune systems until they're, what, about 1 year old?
Yes.
So it hits the baby's immune system with three of these vaccines all at the same time and says, okay, deal with all of this. Whereas if you give one vaccine at a time, then the child has a chance to recover from one before you get the next one.
Right.
So the difference is, if you're worried about vaccines, the answer is not don't do it, because that does leave your child exposed to some diseases that can be life-threatening.
But it's the combination, like you said, it's the combination vaccine, especially the one, measles, mumps, rubella.
Right.
But to get them separately, and again, the question is, in some place they probably can't get them separately.
Yeah, they don't even make them separately sometimes anymore.
Right.
But the difference is also a willingness to invest your own time in spreading those out.
Right. You're right. No, and it's so, and that's basically one of the debates, because there's no scientific study completed yet around tracking it. But, you know, I mean, the question is, autism, the rate of its prevalence now looks like it's 1 in 150 kids. You know, it was never that high.
That's
horrible. Yeah. So
1 in 150 kids means there's 1 in every 5 classrooms.
Right.
And
exactly.
And that's a huge burden on the school system.
Right.
And therefore on our taxpayer pockets.
Right.
So we really need to think about
we need to get at the front end of it.
This.
The jury's still out on exactly what causes autism, but here are some of the leading theories. One concern was with thimerosal, which is a derivative of mercury, which was used as a preservative in some of the vaccines. This practice has been stopped. Almost all of the vaccines now no longer contain thimerosal, but you can ask your doctor specifically about the particular brand. I put into the handout for this program a website that has more information about thimerosal and some of the other theories, so that you can check into it if your child is affected. There's also a theory that it might be connected to an allergy to milk or wheat. So one thing you can do is withdraw all the milk or wheat products and see if that makes a difference in the way your child behaves. So that one you can test at home. The other theory is that it may involve some inability of the child's metabolism to take heavy metals out of the system. Our bodies have a way of excreting heavy metals that we may have been exposed to, like mercury or arsenic in the water or different things like that. And some people's metabolisms do not get rid of these as easily as others. So another theory is to try chelation therapy, C-H-E-L-A-T-I-O-N. Chelation therapy is a way of taking a sort of vitamin supplement that binds heavy metals and helps to take them out of the body. So there's a lot of research going on. Again, we don't know the final, but we do know that today it is 10 times more likely to have a child with autism than it was just 10 years ago. So something very dramatic is happening in our environment. And 1 in 150 is more children than have AIDS, cancer, and diabetes together. So this is a dramatic change in our environment. Let's go back now and talk some more with Leo.
Now, at the same time, for the kids that have it, it's really important to get the right school support. Again, because it is a public health, like you described, it's something where if the children are getting the right kind of behavioral support and the families included in that so they can carry it out at home, we see a difference all the time in folks that get the right services earlier. The long-term impacts, the child's ability to do things for him or herself, And there's some school systems that are in urban centers that for kids that are poorer in poverty areas, they get ignored if the parents aren't advocating. You know, and we have some great family leaders in those areas too, but we see it too often in Boston. We were out in Springfield a few years ago doing some things, and I was sort of shocked at a young man who was 22 who could have been taught more activities of daily living, take care of himself, toileting, all those things, and he had gotten none of that help or education as a younger man because the school system, and obviously they don't do that for the typical child, but they just put it off. And the young man grew up in a poor area. The uncle was now helping raise the young man, but he had not gotten the support he needs. So that happens. Believe it or not, it happens more often than you think.
Right. So part of it is identifying this at an early age, and that means that this child needs to have the proper well baby care. Mm-hmm. And so access to the healthcare system has to play pretty large in doing that, right?
Access to the healthcare system, and there's programs called, actually, to confuse some terms here, I'm going to use another term I used previously called early intervention.
Mm-hmm.
That's a national program for children up to 3 years of age. That's really important for kids, whether they have autism or other disabilities, to get into that. Now, the problem with autism is you may not know your child has autism till he or she is a year old, year and a half, and so you don't get, you know, the full impact or of
right.
the early intervention service. But after, once you do know that, this is what a lot of families struggle with, getting the behavioral support so they can help, you know, educate their child at home better as well as in school.
Right.
And that's not only the healthcare system, but it's also a different way of how we look at school-based education that, again, we don't have to fight with the school. Okay, your child has autism. Let's see, you know, how is he or she doing, adjusting? How is she or he doing, taking what he's learning back home, you know, and really looking at the big picture.
Have they done any analyses of prenatal care and autism?
No. I mean, I'm not familiar with any. I don't think, I mean, my gut feeling would be given the nature of the disability. But, you know, who knows? That could have an impact. You're right. I don't even want to rule anything out. I was just about to rule it out.
No, because, for example, folic acid and neural tube development, I mean, we did definitely identify that some vitamin deficiencies can lead to malformations in the development of the brain and spinal cord.
Right.
So it seems to me that we really ought to take a look at nutritional deficiencies in the mother and how those might affect children coming out with fully developed brains that operate normally versus children with autism.
That could be. There are other, for example, the PKU testing, which happened many years ago, you know, in this country. I want to say it was the late 60s. Massachusetts was, by the way, the first state to implement not only PKU screening, but the nutritional supplement.
This is newborn screening you're talking about,
right.
when a baby that's very young, a day old or so, they take one little drop of blood from the heel and send it off to the lab to check for some of these inborn errors of metabolism.
Right, metabolism, exactly. Yes.
Right, because some of the ways that the baby does or doesn't process food, if they're corrected early on, then the baby can develop normally. But if they're not corrected, they can lead to mental retardation or blindness or deafness. And so they're extremely important to identify early.
And so there could be, you know, other connections. One of the reasons we focused, you know, on the vaccines and related kinds of things is that they leave behind other chemical, you know, what do you call side effects or materials.
Mm-hmm.
And so the thimerosal, for example, debate, you know, in vaccination left behind mercury, you know. And so we don't know how that might have an impact. But you're right, it could also be a matter of, in some cases, because autism spectrum disorders isn't just one disability. You know, there could be a number of causes for this increase.
Because the development of an infant begins at conception.
Right.
There are millions and millions of cells that get created before the baby's actually born.
Good point, yeah.
So I would think we ought to take a look at all of that. And the environmental chemicals, of course, are a big factor. Whenever someone has a child with any genetic disease that has never been in the family before, they'll come and say to me, what did I do wrong? You know, I had my I had a permanent wave when I was pregnant, or I had new carpeting put in. Could this be an effect? And in fact, we don't know, but those are things that we ought to take a hard look at. And as you say, the smell from the plastic, even that new car smell, you know, could be indicating that there are particulates in the air that could be causing us harm.
Exactly. Great point.
We'll be back in a moment to speak more with Leo Sarkissian about how we can get the society to be more accepting of all people with disabilities, including the many veterans who are coming back to us with all kinds of wounds and disabilities, not all of which are visible.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
Welcome back. We're going to speak some more with Leo Sarkissian in a minute about how we can help the society be more accepting of all people with disabilities. Before we go back to him, I'd like to share with you a description of why there are so many brain injuries amongst the veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. There's a new phenomenon there called improvised explosive devices, or IEDs. And these are leading to shell shock. You know, we used to call it shell shock in the First World War, but people are really getting this kind of brain injury in a phenomenal way. As many as, I've seen estimates from 1/2 to 82% of the veterans coming back from the Middle East having been exposed to this kind of brain injury. And let me read you this description by Dr. Ronald Glasser, who's a nephrologist who spent 3 years as an army surgeon in Japan in the Vietnam War, and he's describing the problem with these brain injuries. Quote, "For the first time, the U.S. military is treating more head injuries than chest or abdominal wounds and is ill-fitted to do so. According to a July 2005 estimate from Walter Reed Army Medical Center, 2/3 of all soldiers wounded in Iraq who don't immediately return to duty have traumatic brain injuries. And here's why IEDs carry such a hidden danger. The detonation of any powerful explosive generates a blast wave of high pressure that spreads out at 1,600 feet per second from the point of explosion and travels hundreds of yards. The lethal blast wave is a two-part assault that first rattles the brain against the skull. The initial shock wave of very high pressure is followed closely by the, quote, secondary wind, unquote, a huge volume of displaced air flooding back into the area, again under high pressure. No helmet or armor can defend against such a massive wave front, unquote. So these differences in pressure are what rocks the head, rocks the brain, and sloshes the brain around inside the skull. He says the blast waves causing traumatic brain injuries can leave a 19-year-old private who could easily run a 6-minute mile unable to stand or even to think. Indeed, soldiers walking away from IED blasts have discovered that they often suffer from memory loss, short attention spans, muddled reasoning, headaches, confusion, anxiety, depression, and irritability." Unquote. Now, a lot of these things can be helped if people get immediate care that's correct. The recognition that there is this problem and the correct kind of intervention can, in fact, cause some improvement. But the problem is that in warfare, there are so many people with more urgent injuries, you know, like they've lost a leg or they're bleeding all over the place. So obviously those get to the top of the triage list and they get care first. And these kinds of more silent injuries don't always get care for some time. So the fact that they're not getting early intervention, and in many cases the fact that they're not getting any intervention, means that they go home to their families with this level of confusion and inability to function correctly. Even though they look perfectly fine, they look uninjured, and they come home and they really are not able to cope. So that's the latest wave of brain injury problems that we're facing as a society. And of course, it is increasing our awareness of the fact that any brain injury, including sports injuries, getting thrown playing football, can cause this kind of traumatic brain injury as well. So we need to pay a lot more attention to this kind of injury and how to treat it. And in fact, 2 weeks from now, I'm going to be talking with a specialist from a new company that is working specifically on ways that we can help people recover from this kind of injury, recover their memory, their ability to focus, and so forth, and hopefully help people to get back to work, get back to being part of their family. Let's go back now and talk some more with Leo.
So how do we help the society be more accepting of people with all kinds of disabilities? We've got people coming back from Iraq now who are, you know, have very real physical disabilities, but also the highest rate of traumatic brain injury we have ever seen in a war. People who survived these roadside bombings, but their heads have been significantly damaged and their brains are not working at full speed.
Well, I agree. I mean, I think in the long run, maybe some obligation to these veterans might help us get back on track as we were in the 70s and 80s trying to address, develop more disability programs. I'd say there's two levels to it. One is from sort of the individual community level, where the families that are involved with ARC and similar groups try to educate people around them, starting with the extended family, you know, neighbors. And don't keep your kid, you know, disability outside of programs, outside of normal, you know, after-school things. Try to keep them involved as much as possible. Educate the people around you, because that relates then to jobs, you know, for people.
Right. Well,
you know, that relates to so many things, being able to take advantage of the same community recreational areas that are open to everybody. But oftentimes, some children with disabilities can't take advantage of them, and or the family's nervous because they, you know, They have gotten bad, you know, cues or vibes from people, so they then avoid them. So that's one level of sort of what we can do to make it better.
Yeah, I was thinking it takes a lot of courage on the part of the family to do that, because they are going to hit some resistances from the community and from other people who just say thoughtless things.
Right.
So it takes a lot of courage, first of all, to accept your child to the point that you're willing to go do that, and secondly, to be ready to confront whatever the issues are that may come up. Some other parent saying, you know, can't you control your child better? You have to have some pleasant but firm things to say in a case like that.
Right, right.
Can
we
you
were
give
at a water
an example.
Right. Well, I was at a water park the other day, and and I will give you an example where a young man, he must have been 14, the younger sibling, a sister, and he clearly, you know, I think he would be in the ASD somewhere, and his parents, you know, walked into the water park, and he was making noises, you know, not prolonged, you know, not nonstop, but once in a while make a noise. In that case, I happened to see the people accepted very well, all right? And they obviously had been to the water park before. It wasn't an issue. And what I think someone has to say, if someone sort of, it really depends how it happens. Like if someone's just mentioning something, they're not really talking to you, you know, the best thing to do is to ignore it, I think. But if someone actually says, can you, you know, tries to take you on, so to speak, and can't you handle your child better? I say, you know, sorry, maybe you don't appreciate my child. Just be direct and clear, factual about the disability. Mm-hmm. My child happens to have a disability. If you want to be more specific, you know, what the disability is, this has an effect on, you know, how he's able to speak or how he's able to respond to this situation. Mm-hmm. But we want to make sure he grows up as independently as possible.
Right.
That's why we're here, you know. And we want to also enjoy things as a family, you know.
Right.
And maybe they'll get maybe that will educate them, and maybe it won't. But at the very least, not to be defensive and not to feel. You have to be confident. You're right. You have to have some strength behind you, because it could easy to feel either embarrassed or I shouldn't be here, you know?
And it's not constructive to snap back at that parent.
Oh, not at all.
Not at all. I mean, that can be totally counterproductive.
Right.
So you have to have grace under fire, as it were.
No, it demands a lot, I think. And then, again, there's good people. Usually, you know, I know what parents have said to me is sometimes in situations like that, you usually find somebody else who's pretty supportive in the sort of crowd, and that often helps. And, you know, so I think today, I mean, I was saying that's the one level. The second level, we've got to do a better job publicly, doing better public education,
right?
Billboards, some, you know, different articles in the press, which there are many more articles, things like this discussion.
Right.
These all help. And then finally, we need more funding for services. For people with disabilities, because, again, if that doesn't happen, you know, you do end up in a situation where people don't have the support they need. You know, we have an aging population. A lot of, you know, the number that's thrown out there right now from the survey conducted in 2006, a health survey, that all ages in terms of people that have disabilities, it's somewhere around 11.8% of the population.
Mm-hmm.
We have a population of around 273 million people in the United States. And one of the things related for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities is a lot of those that may need support, whether they have autism or historically, you know, disabilities such as the Down syndrome, cerebral palsy,
mm-hmm.
who are getting right now support through caregivers, those caregivers are getting older. And in a national report on the state of the state of disabilities, we were looking at some pretty high numbers in terms of people that are getting to the point where they won't be able to care. I think it's something like 2.8 million in 2000. This is 2004 number.
Right.
2.8 million people of the 4.6 million persons with intellectual and developmental disabilities in the U.S. were receiving residential support from a family member, okay,
mm-hmm.
so a family
mm-hmm.
caregiver. And an estimated, I think, 710,000 of that number were living with caregivers who are 60 years of age or older. This
right.
is in 2004. So
right.
you have to do something.
Or...
Right, exactly. Or even, it could be a 38-year-old living with, you know,
right.
66-year-old. Now, you combine that with the war veterans, you know, coming back, right. as you were talking about. You combine that with some of the needs that are there for, you know, younger people who need more support and behavioral intervention, maybe not residential.
Mm-hmm.
We do have, you know, in Massachusetts, which is seen as a progressive state, our increases in services have really been held below 3%. In fact, this year, the year before last, it was under 2% in the budget, this budget year that just ended, 2008.
Right.
So that's pretty scary, you know,
nationally. And in hard times,
mm-hmm.
that tends to be the end of the budget that's cut first. It's the
yes.
people with no voice who get their services cut first.
Right. And you know, we have, honestly, in the legislature, we have some pretty sympathetic ears.
Right.
You know, and even with that, because of the reality of the revenue situation, and there's roads to fix, and there's pensions to pay, you know, there's the new
right,
health care
right.
plan in
right.
Massachusetts. Nationally, you know, I don't think there's another state yet that has as comprehensive a plan as we do. But so these pressures, and I think nationwide, at least 19 states are facing significant deficits.
Right.
So
right.
that's the kind of thing that really...
It's a sign of the times.
Right.
Let me take a little break here now and remind you, please, to go to powerfulpatient.org And on the website, you will find not only this program that you can call up on demand, but also a handout that goes with the show that explains a little bit more about our guests, about the topics that we've spoken about. And if you want to go into greater detail on this topic, there are some websites listed and some facts about the conditions that we've talked about autism and about brain injury, and hopefully you'll find some more resources there. So please do go to powerfulpatient.org. You'll find the handout that goes with this show. And also, we would ask you please to make a donation to powerfulpatient.org and the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Family Alliance. Help us to support this program and also to find a cure for von Hippel-Lindau disease and other genetic cancer syndromes. It's really amazing the progress that we're making. And we still need to do a lot of work, and we really need your help to get it done. Thank you very much. And now let's go back and talk some more with Leo Sarkissian about how we can train the next generation to be more accepting of people with all manner of handicaps.
One of the other things that I was thinking as we were talking is that by mainstreaming these children, by putting them in the schools and bucking the attitudes of the parents and so forth, we are hopefully training the children to be more accepting of people who are a little different.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's going to be extremely important as we move forward. We need to change those attitudes in the classroom and not just when people are 40. I was walking to work the other day, and there was a teenager, a young man, who was in an electric wheelchair tootling down the sidewalk with his girlfriend sitting on his lap. Mm-hmm. And I thought, this is so cool. I love
That's
it.
That's great. Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Here's a mainstream kid with a girlfriend who's accepted who he is, and I was just beaming.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the kind of thing we all need to understand, that these are wonderful people. Sometimes they have a very strong spirit, but they may act a little different, or they may be a little funny to look at, or they'll have some difference that may need accommodation.
Mm-hmm.
But when we accommodate those needs, they can be your most loyal employees, their best spouse, and that's, I think, a very important lesson.
Yes, that's a great point. I love the image of the young man in the wheelchair.
The kid in the wheelchair.
Great. Yeah.
Yeah. One of my grandsons is in a classroom with a little boy who's autistic, and this little boy acts out and hits other children. And so it's been a learning experience for my grandson to learn how to realize that he didn't do anything wrong. The other kid is not being mean. It's just sort of part of his problem.
Wow.
And he has to back off and understand that. But that's a very hard thing for a second grader to learn.
Right, and imagine, and this is the thing, that's in a situation where if he's learning that, that means I bet you they have a pretty good program in place.
Right.
There's probably some behavioral therapists working with the teacher and doing, you know what I mean? I don't think, but how many classrooms don't you have that level of sort of input and discussion and training? That's, and basically the kid ends up going to a separate classroom somewhere.
Right, but it takes a lot of understanding on the part of the parents, too, to reinforce that and not just get uppity and say, what's this violent child doing in my son's classroom?
And that's the scary part, because sometimes people just have a knee-jerk reaction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think, again, depending on the child and how often that kind of behavior occurs, there's different ways to handle that. Sometimes you need to have a class meeting, invite parents in early, proactive, you know, sort of plan ahead.
Mm-hmm.
So that the parents can get the update before anything ever happens in the class, because they may not have any clue about this, and explain, you know, how it, you know, why we're, you know, integration works, you know, why it's going to be a, in the long run, a better thing, but also that your children are going to be basically safe, you know, and the teacher's being trained. But you're right, because otherwise, there's many situations where I would say it would be more common that people would go in, complain.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that child in my classroom with my son, you know? Have him or her removed.
Right, and there was a book written recently by an adult who's autistic, as I recall.
Actually, there's a few, and I'm trying to remember. You're going to put me on a spot here, but one of the writers is Temple Grandin, who's, if people want to Google her name, G-R-A-N-D-I-N, Temple Grandin. She's a Ph.D., and she described how it was for her to have autism, but there's others who have, I mean, you know, there's several, you know, good books out there written not only from people with autism ASD, but also others who are parents, family members, you know, folks that work that are great to get some background.
So these are some success stories. These are people who have learned how to manage their differences and succeed in our world.
Right, right. And what's the thing about Temple Grandin's book, I, at one point describing, she would describe her... you know, her sensation of her environment as a younger person.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so different than ours because of whatever was going on with the neurological pathways. So, you know, sometimes it can be light, you know, it can be the way people can't touch you, you know, because of what it triggers. There was a great article in the New Yorker magazine less than a year ago about two men who have not autism, but a condition that literally sets off self-abusive behavior, and it was not an ASD, you know, it wasn't in the syndrome, and I can't tell you the name of it, but it was just so well written. These men were in a group home. They often die, you know, under the age of 40, you know, but they were doing well, and they were able to verbalize and even describe, you know, what happens inside, you know, as they do,
right.
Some of the things they do, and basically, and that's a very unusual condition, by the way. You know, it's the first time I had read of that condition. And I thought, wow, what a public service, you know,
right.
Sharing this.
Well, in our fast-moving society, we kind of expect everybody to be stamped out of a cookie cutter and doing a certain level of work. And otherwise, they just don't seem to fit into the society.
Mm-hmm.
But in other societies, they take every child as a gift from God, and if nothing else, they teach you patience. They teach you love with a depth that you sometimes don't take the time to experience with everyone.
Right, right. That's a great point.
Yeah. Anything else that you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Just want to encourage people to, you know, please learn a little more about it. You can go to thearc.org, which is our national, you know, website, thearc.org, or if you want to learn more about autism specifically, there's a couple of websites I can mention. AutismSpeaks.org is one. It's just the word Autism Speaks. And then there's the Society, National Society for Autism, which has been around for years, and they have a website as well, and you can Google that and find that. And in Massachusetts, we have Advocates for Autism of Massachusetts, as well as the arcmass.org. They're welcome to visit.
Thank you very, very much for being with us today. And I'd like to add, too, that if you're thinking about having a child, both parents need to think about nutrition, need to give up smoking, need to limit their alcohol, and give your developing baby every possible chance to be healthy and well.
Great. Thank you, Joyce. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Righto.
Bye-bye.
Let me remind you that 2 weeks ago in show 0835, week 35 of 2008, we did an interview with Dr. Jean Wilson about fertility and pregnancy and making sure that you have all the nutrients, the right environment for a baby to develop as normally as they possibly can. So we want to make sure that all those cells divide correctly and the chemical environment is great for a developing baby to try to make sure that everything gets developed just right. So that's one element. We don't have proof around that yet, but certainly it's not going to do any harm, and it just might make the difference. So it's a very good idea. We have a show coming up next week with Jill Ann Schneider, who is an expert in nutrition and particularly in juicing. So if you're interested in juicing, that is not the bodybuilding sense of juicing, but rather the nutrient sense of taking vegetables and fruits and turning them into liquid that you can drink and that will deliver the nutrients to your body more efficiently. So we'll explore juicing next week with Jill Ann Schneider. And then in 2 weeks' time, we have a show coming up that's very relevant to the topic we discussed today. And that's an interview with one of the experts from a company called Posit Science that's developed a brain fitness program scientifically proven to enhance cognitive function. And this program is aimed primarily at people in the aging population to help you think faster, focus better, and remember more. So to help counteract the aging process kinds of we get to be forgetful or one thing and another, and they have some exercises for your brain to keep you sharp and to keep you from losing that edge. They've also got a contract now with the military, and they're using this with people with brain injury. So for people with various kinds of brain injury, this is a good fitness program. It's almost like physical therapy for your brain. So it's a program worth exploring if you have any kind of brain injury that you're dealing with, as well as for the aging process. So please be with us in 2 weeks' time. That'll be show number 40, 2008 show 40. Will be the interview with Posit Science about their brain fitness program. And as always, please look on the website for the handout that goes with this show. You'll find the websites that we talked about listed there and some additional information about both brain injury and about autism and other kinds of handicaps that are intellectual handicaps or developmental handicaps that lead to these very occult, hidden disabilities, the ones that you can't tell from looking at somebody that they may be having a struggle going on inside, but they're nonetheless very, very real and things that we need to appreciate, to understand, and to make some reasonable accommodations for, because people who have these kinds of brain injuries can learn to be an integral part of our society, can learn to be independent if they have the right kinds of support. And so when it's a question of mainstreaming a child in your child's classroom, please be supportive of that, because it not only helps the family who is dealing with this disability, it also, frankly, helps you and your child to become more understanding of the whole range of the human condition. Not everybody is perfect, as all of us know, because we're not perfect. But when there's somebody who's even a little less perfect, they, with a little accommodation, I think you'll find that the experience of knowing that person and getting to appreciate that person's own talents and strengths is a very enriching experience in your own life. So we hope to appreciate everybody and to work together to make this society work and to embrace the soldiers who are coming back from the Middle East with these kinds of brain injuries, to help them get mainstreamed back into society, get back to work, get back to being mothers and fathers and children themselves, and an integral part of our society. It's an extremely important step that we need to make to embrace these people who have given so much of themselves to serve our country. They deserve to be served in return as they come back and join us again. So I hope that you will have a good week and that we will see you again next week. And meanwhile, be well and be a powerful patient. Thank you.